Hello and welcome to the podcast. So today we've got Stephen Andrews in, and he's going to be sharing his experiences and what he's kind of gone on to do. Stephen, I guess best thing to do is for you to give us a brief introduction to yourself and also what you've kind of done.
Yeah, of course. Excellent. Yeah, so absolutely, it's been great to be a part of this podcast, and thank you ever so much for allowing me to join you today. And also, you know, a big hello to all of our listeners as well. It's great to also have them here as well. And certainly around the things that I've done in the past is I love the sense of adventure, and I love the sense of challenge and some goals as well. So back in 2015, I joined a group of people where we had a expedition to Kilimanjaro. So we did that in September. And then from there, I had that kind of spark of love of climbing mountains and that sense of adventure and just going to, you know, travel. So 2016, went to Mount Toubkal, which is the Atlas Mountains, which that's the highest in North Africa. But Kilimanjaro is the highest freestanding mountain in the world and highest in Africa. And that's one of the, one of the seven summits in the world as well. So in 2017, my wife and I, we kind of packed up our bags and, you know, lived down, you know, out of the hand luggage life and explored different, 12 countries all in all in about 5 to 6 months. And after that, in April 2018, I joined a team and we did a expedition to Mirror Peak, which is the one of the highest trekking peaks in the Himalaya, and it was 6,476 meters, and we did that over the course of 3 weeks as well. So yeah, that was a fantastic experience. So yeah, I hope that gives you a bit of a sense.
Yeah, so brilliant. Quite into the mountain climbing then.
Yeah, love it. Absolutely love it. Definitely. Not so much at the moment, but I'm certainly looking forward to getting myself back out there and, you know, doing some more adventures in due course. But yeah, definitely.
Amazing. So yeah. if we kind of go back, kind of childhood, like, were you active? Has this come from, you know, adventures beforehand? Like, tell me a bit about what you were like when you were younger.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, great question. I think if I kind of reflect back on where I was, younger, I was massive into my basketball. Loved playing basketball a lot. I was one of those kids, you know, out in like the school field, lunchtime, you know, even after school, playing basketball, even with like, you know, by myself or some other people as well that I used to play basketball with at the time. And I've very much like very led an active lifestyle. But actually from there, so we're going back around, this was around 13 or 14 years old at the time. And I really wanted to kind of progress into, you know, basketball really, and, you know, started to train with, you know, a few people around like the UK. But then I focused my time around skateboarding actually, which I really love and still skateboard as well. So this was when I was like 16, 17, 18 years old. And, you know, absolutely love skateboarding, love the culture as part of it as well. And I think kind of looking back on back to where I was at the time when I was skateboarding, to if I kind of look back in terms of my perspective and look back at that time now, it really developed a kind of sense of my kind of philosophy in life really around skateboarding, because what it taught me, and I didn't really know this at the time, because all I wanted to do is land my damn tricks and like, you know, try and do some good stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of find that my approach to, you know, skateboarding has really kind of supported me in my upbringing, right, and my life skills. And I kind of found that actually when I kind of set my mind on doing a new trick and I wanted to, you know, try and figure that out, well, of course, I got a bit nervous. I got a bit apprehensive. I don't know what to expect. Don't know what to do. But certainly around, you know, trying it anyway and just giving it a go. And of course, I failed more times. But actually, during in that process is, well, I kind of went to do those tricks anyway, didn't land most of them. But actually, I trying to figured out what I was doing wrong. And yeah. how did I figure myself out? And how do I do this trick? And what am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? And we've all got to try and figure that kind of stuff out, right? But then eventually you land the trick and you go, yes, brilliant, fantastic. I'm going to do it even more now. And, you know, you start to build that up. And actually, I tend to kind of, you know, use that approach as, you know, a philosophy in the way that I like to approach goals. And I think that kind of set up myself in that kind of sense of training for adventure and joining those expeditions as well. And yeah.
It's funny how the kind of physical things that we go through can almost pave the way for how we deal with other situations. And yeah. I know that from what we've kind of talked about already, and we will touch on probably throughout this conversation, is this concept of resilience and the ability to kind of get back up, dust yourself off, and then
go again.
Yeah. It's just amazing how, you know, something like skateboarding or any sports can really set the foundation for that.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah, it's really, really great. And certainly they, you know, sport in my life is, you know, certainly a big part of that growing up. Definitely.
Yeah. So moving on from the skateboarding,
mm-hmm.
where did you go next?
Yeah, went into ultimately around into more music based stuff, actually. But actually, this was 2005 and 2006. And this was at the time about when I started to identify that there was some issues physically within myself. And that's more of a kind of a hip related condition which I developed. And this was actually probably due to a very high active lifestyle where I was in basketball and skateboard, and that actually I developed a hip condition, which we can get into, you know, a bit later if you want. And then led for me to go into more kind of music. Really enjoyed DJing, and certainly around that kind of spent about 6 or 7 years doing that as well. So, and then that kind of brings us up to 2012, 2013 is about when I actually moved into more kind of getting back into more of a kind of an active lifestyle again. So
yeah. So let's talk about this hip condition, because I know it kind of plays a pretty pivotal role in your story, right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So I didn't know this at the time. And, you know, a big shout out to Guy's Hospital, because they've done an absolutely amazing, you know, work with me as well. And, you know, being taken care of, you know, those surgeons there are absolutely fantastic. And certainly around with what I noticed at the time is when I was skateboarding, when I was walking, sometimes I had a really reduced amount of movement and flexibility mm-hmm. within my hip. Like that was showing up for me, even walking, even changing direction, standing up, sitting down, even just sitting down or standing up for too long was, you know, sometimes quite painful. So navigated through various different appointments, MRI scans, x-rays, things like that. And we went into the orthopedics department at Guy's Hospital, and it turns out that the technical term for it is a femoral acetabular impingement, which mm-hmm. basically means that I had a growth spur on my ball of my femur, which basically where the ball of the femur sits inside the pelvis, it was actually rubbing against my pelvis, and actually it was wearing away some of my cartilage, which actually, you know, had a real kind of reduced in kind of movement. So taking that as a, you know, an active person, love being, you know, skateboarding and, you know, going to basketball, and actually being told into going, okay, you have this condition here, which we need to operate on. We don't know how long this is going to be, but I don't think that you can really play an active lifestyle in your sport for the foreseeable future. And, you know, something that, you know, it took some, you know, adapting, but also at the time it was really difficult to make that kind of, you know, that shift in my life, because of course sport was very, very important to me at the time. But of course, you know, I kind of focused my energy on kind of music and, you know, really enjoyed that. Going out with friends, of course, and, you know, I can still kind of walk about and going out partying, of course, which was great. But actually that there was, you know, certainly a kind of a limitation that was showing up for me. And then had my operation in 2010. So Guy's Hospital did a open surgical dislocation. So they basically kind of, perhaps they got a bit of sandpaper. Who knows? I was out at the time, but they, but they sorted me out, man. So that was good. So then that led for me to being on crutches and kind of limited movement for about 3 months. And then during that kind of time, I also had like 3 pins like welded into the side of my femur as well, because they what they wanted to do is kind of correct the anatomy for me and just making sure it's all kind of sitting sweet, which they certainly did, which was great. But also that kind of led for me to not being active and being on my feet, which kind of led to my muscle depletion as well. So I had to build that up. But as I got back into kind of walking again, and, you know, I tried to train myself of using the kind of crutches less. But then after that, during those 2 years, I still had those pins in the side of my femur, which was actually more of a kind of a limitation for me. So, I didn't necessarily be able to go skateboarding or go basketball and really high active sports. So that was still showing up for me. But actually in 2012, when I had the 3 pins removed from my femur, brilliant, great. I was able to sit cross-legged again. And that was amazing. That was a brilliant, realization to actually go, okay, now I can start to do my kind of active things.
Yeah.
But that kind of left me physically and mentally in a more of a kind of a limitation kind of mode, because I was so used to not being able to sit cross-legged or go running or go walking or change direction or sprint or jog or run or go and flip, my board about and, go and drop in and things like that. So that kind of left for me as a more of a kind of thing where I, needed to, train new things. And really just rekindle my kind of love for sport again, really. So yeah, that was 2012, 2013.
Amazing. So if we go back to when you initially found out that you obviously, or initially there was this limitation imposed upon you by, doctors and or surgeons. Now, how did that feel?
Man, that felt tough.
Yeah.
Felt tough. Because actually that the condition at that time was quite new in the UK. There wasn't that much research and kind of development inside of the actual condition. So I was there with my surgeons going, okay, well, what would this give me if I do this operation? It was like, well, they don't know the real long-term effects of this because this is new, but they're going on what they know now. So they don't have any person to really kind of, provide me a bit of guidance on this is what it's going to be like in 5 to 10 years time. But kind of looking at it now, I'm so glad and so pleased I went through it, because actually for the long term aspect on things, it allowed me to do so much more again and lead that kind of active and sporting kind of lifestyle again. So yeah, but at that time it was a sense of uncertainty and unknown kind of aspect on things, of going, well, we don't really know too much about this. Shall I do this? Shall I not? But if I don't do this, what's the impact? And, if I do it, what's the impact there? So I think, there was a sense of just, putting faith into the hands of the surgeons and putting faith into the, kind of system and their skills as well. So
yeah,
it was a sense about that, but yeah, it was all kind of driven by hope and faith that I would get back to, a normality and, which will allow me to do my sporting activities again.
Because how old were you at this kind of time?
Oh, damn. So I was about 25 at the time. Yeah.
It's quite a lot of faith to be putting in,
man.
People with such a big thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. But yeah, they did an absolutely fantastic job and I'm forever grateful of, being under their care was absolutely fantastic and grateful to, be under their care. Definitely.
Yeah. So tell me about transitioning from, so you've gone through the surgery, obviously you had your pins in, which has limited you somewhat. you now go and get your pins taken out and you can essentially do anything.
Yeah.
But you still have this almost, like, is it fair to say psychological restraint?
Yeah, definitely.
How do you then transition back into doing all that stuff again?
Yeah, and with great difficulty.
Yeah, I can only imagine, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. And certainly it's around, I think it starts with that self-awareness more than anything. It like starts of going, actually, yeah, I'm kind of, is this my body telling me that? Or is this my mind telling me that? What is that? And what would happen if I just go just a bit more further, run just a bit more, like, you know, walk just a bit more, speed walk, things like that, just to test that out and actually just trying to understand, is it me holding me back or is it my body holding me back? Because actually, it was me holding me back.
Yeah.
And how do I need to get out of my own way
to yeah.
allow myself to get back into that active lifestyle again, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of fascinating hearing this because there's so much research, especially in pain science, showing that a lot of the time it'll be the individual who kind of limits themselves because of fear of pain rather than the actual pain being present, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure. And definitely at that time it was, oh, well, I did this before and it resulted in pain. And this is, you know, resulted in pain for about 3 to 4 years.
Yeah.
But if I'm trying it now and I remember that, am I just half expecting that pain to happen? So therefore I'm not going to jump myself into that because I don't want to put myself under more pain. But yeah. actually, when you go ahead and do that, you're actually training yourself by going, actually, you can do this now.
Yeah.
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 So yeah, that was a, you know, that was a journey, you know, which kind of took around about a year or so more than anything. You know, it showed up in various kind of ways really of like, you know, walking without those crutches, walking, you know, from the train station to work for about, you know, 30 minutes each way at the time, things like that, which was really important for me to get into that kind of rhythm again of being quite active again. And, you know, working at the time and being on my feet all day was really important. Of course, you know, sitting down and standing up, it's all those types of things which I kind of had to take into kind of consideration from there. So,
yeah. So how do you, you know, what was the kind of time period between being able to move again, like mm-hmm. fully,
yeah.
and then climbing Kilimanjaro, which was the first big climb, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's it. So the process was that I kind of got to the point of going, do you know what? I'm okay. I can do this. I can lead, you know, everyday work and, you know, personal demands, you know, walking, standing, things like that. That's absolutely fine. But I wanted to kind of set a new challenge and I wanted to, you know, have a new adventure, create a new memory and just, you know, having that kind of goal to work towards to try and level up on getting myself back to where I was. And that kind of came from, right, well, mountains, never really done this before. Yeah, I've done, like, you know, UK, you know, kind of trekking peaks, Snowdon, Ben Nevis, and they were absolutely great and, you know, still do it now and absolutely love them. But I wanted to do something a bit more, go a bit more further. And it came from a sense of challenge, but also a sense of curiosity as well, because I love that kind of sense of adventure and kind of challenging myself and going, mm-hmm. Steve, you're making yourself a promise here to go ahead and go do this.
Yeah.
This is an element of risk. You don't know what the altitude is going to be like. You don't know what you're going to be like when you're there. It's, you know, the highest freestanding mountain in the world. And you've never really, you know, done this before and you don't know what altitude is going to be. So I set a little mini goal and I booked Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
Because it was absolutely fine. It's kind of like, you know, entry level. They were more than happy to, you know, have me there and they kind of knew from what my past was like and that was great. But then the mini goal was I need to be the best that I've been physically and mentally.
Mm-hmm.
That is going to give me the gateway of going, if for whatever reason, if I don't make the summit due to my health, due to my physical, health.
Yeah.
And I wasn't at the fittest that I've ever been. Well, then that's something in my control. That's on me.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, if I can say that I've been the fittest physically and mentally that I've ever been, well, then if I don't make that, summit to Kilimanjaro, well, that's okay. Because do you know what? I'm at the fittest that I've ever been. I've yeah. gone through this cycle and I'll be at peace with that. I wouldn't be at peace with like myself if I wasn't the fittest that I've ever been and I didn't make that summit because of that.
Yeah.
And it was that promise that I made to myself of going, right, okay, you need to be the fittest that you've ever been. Where do I start with this? Where, what does one do? So at the time, actually, so this was 2014.
Yeah.
I came across the body coach, Joe Wicks, actually, and he was just starting out at that time. And I was like, okay, do you know what? It sounds like a really good 90-day plan. This sounds definitely up my street. So let's sign myself up to that. And that's what I did. And at the time, Joe was like my personal coach. So it was like, doing email trails of, sending my yeah. measurements to him, after months. And yeah, so that was great. But after the 90-day plan, well, actually, let's, talk about within that 90-day plan is actually what I needed to do is I need to understand where I was right now. What do I need to train into my life? But also, what do I need to train out of my life? And by training out of my life was the things such as smoking 10 cigarettes a day,
mm-hmm.
Loving up the sausage McMuffins and those hash browns are so good. Do you know what
they
I mean?
They do taste good, don't they?
Oh, they're so good. They're so good. But very difficult to train out. Because they're so good. And then, the meal deals and,
yeah.
Fizzy drinks, things like that. And those are the types of things which I need to be aware of that I need to train out of my life. Reducing the amount of alcohol that I was drinking on like a weekly basis. I need to train that out of my life. Okay, what is it that I need to train into my life? And that is definitely from the philosophies of that 90-day plan, such yeah. as HIIT workouts. And I kind of felt, well, there's not that many hills and mountains in Hertfordshire, right? So what type of things do I need to do in order for me to get to be fitter and lead mm-hmm. an active lifestyle? And what I kind of felt is actually, well, they say that at altitude that your heart rate goes higher and it's very, very difficult for the respiratory system. So actually HIIT workouts would be a great way to really train myself into that. So I was getting up, my new habits were 5 a.m. Getting up, doing my HIIT workouts and doing them. Burpees, I learned about how much I hate burpees. So I was doing them, lots of different things. And I was doing that for about 20 to 30 minutes before work, without fail for about 9 to 10 months, I think. Mm-hmm. But actually, like the 90-day plan was only, of course, 90 days, but I wanted to continue on doing that, And I think it was really important for me to get into that rhythm, adopt those new habits, which was really important. And with that in mind, I think it was important around not only around my physical activities, but also what type of food that I was eating as well. So coming from training out of my life in the type of foods that I was eating back then, but also training into my life of going, okay, I need to have a carbohydrate meal after my workout, then a low carb meal, two of them. Throughout the day, the snacks, nuts, apples, drinking so much more water than I was before, drinking around 3 to 4 liters of water a day. Whereas usually I'll just be on the coffee and fizzy drinks, that's a real difficult, thing to kind of shift at that time for me. But it was really important for me to get into that kind of habit of doing that.
Yeah.
So it got to it and, it was really, really successful and I felt amazing. I was sleeping better and I just felt mentally so much better and just so much more clearer.
Yeah.
And that really, really helped. And that's something which I didn't necessarily expect. And also it kind of helped with, my skills of making food. Really necessarily expect as well. You know, I was leading the kind of Tupperware, you know, batch cook life, you know, and that was great. And, you know, I didn't necessarily, you know, find that there was going to be like that new skill that I was going to be doing, but that was a byproduct, which I didn't necessarily know that I was going to be expecting to do, like as a, you know, making my own food and getting skillful at, you know, about making my own food. So yeah, that was a, you know, unexpected surprise, which was fantastic, and certainly welcome. So yeah, that was great.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much awesome stuff there, right? And I guess in taking on this challenge, there was so much change, right? Mm-hmm. But what really struck me there was when you were talking about that goal, right, and that almost personal responsibility of, it doesn't matter it doesn't matter the end result if I can't control it, but I am going to do everything in my control to make sure that I get to that end result. How do you come up with that mindset? Because it's not something, I don't think, especially now in my experience, it's not something that naturally just comes to people.
Interesting. Yeah, definitely. I think what I wanted to try and do is I wanted to, because with a goal like that, and just like with any goal, sometimes that, you know, we would kind of look at it, and then sometimes there could be some elements of self-doubt and elements of risk. And what I was very aware about what would, you know, happen is I could put myself at risk, you know, during this mountain expedition. I could put other people at risk during that expedition. And me, by going, oh, do you know what? No, you know, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to smash it. No. Let's put the ego aside here and just go, right, use it as confidence, use it as motivation, but actually let's just be real with myself and just being transparent and being open enough about where I am with my fitness right now. And it was a kind of elements of, well, I needed to focus on the things that I can control rather than the things that I can't control. But actually what I can control is me, with how I approach my fitness, what new habits do I need to, you know, to create and adopt in order for me to go ahead and go do that. So yeah, it was, you know, ultimately I need to be the fittest that I've been. That then allowed myself to be, okay, you can go and do this.
Yeah. Because as you said, the altitude, you just don't know, right? I think that's something people never really think about, that if you are going to go up into mountains where altitude can affect you, there is a chance it will affect you. You know, my little brother did the trail to Machu Picchu.
Oh, lovely. Yeah.
And suffered horrendously with altitude sickness. Didn't eat for like 3 days. Something that you just don't think about. You can do all this training and then it can just stop you in your tracks almost, right?
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. Yes, it can, because it is that, you know, sense of unknown, because our bodies, you know, they are fragile, but actually they're adaptable. And when they're adaptable, you can get stronger.
Yeah.
You can, definitely. So yeah, it's around, you know, at that time. And when you're, you know, doing these treks, you just need to have that kind of sense of, well, what type of things that are showing up for me right now, which I need to, you know, work with and deal with. Mm-hmm. And what type of things do I need to eradicate the small problems before they become big problems?
Yeah.
And, you know, I used a lot of different experiences from kind of different people about going, hey, talk to me about what it's like at, you know, altitude. And, you know, coming from that is some of the things that they kind of mentioned is you need to drink a lot more water than you do, normally. And I'm like, damn, I'm like just drinking about 3 or 4 liters of water. And that's loads. What? So you're telling me that I need to drink more? It's like, yeah, because of the, you know, to reboost yourself with the lack of O2 that you're getting from the air, that you need to make up with drinking water. I was like, ah, so these are the types of
things
that really kind of helped me if I can't, you know, from like, basically for like my preparation, really. So,
So who were you kind of questioning? Who could provide those insights?
So number one, it was the trekking company. So I used them as well. And of course, our lovely friend called YouTube. Exactly. Yeah. You know, lots of knowledge on there. And that was really important for me to, you know, have that kind of sense of openness of going, hey, I need to gather some knowledge here. And I need to gather some knowledge from, you know, people who have basically done it before. Yeah. So, yeah.
So what was the like main, because the thing that I really get from you is that you really did a lot of research and really approached this whole process as like an intellectual problem, right? So you had the fitness element, but you also had habits that would potentially hold you back. So you had the habits that would hold you back that you needed to kind of change also while putting in these new habits. Also while having to like research this goal and learn about what you needed to do and the state you needed to get to be physically and I guess mentally prepared enough to go up. And that's quite a lot, really. And I just wonder if there was like what really kind of pushed you towards that.
Yeah, I just think I wanted to you know, say to myself that, you know, I'm back being, you know, leading an active lifestyle. And, you know, I, you know, had that promise to myself of going, do you know what? Let's go and, you know, do something which is going to challenge you. Get outside your comfort zone and just, you know, have that sense of adventure, have a sense of travel, do something new. And I think that kind of, I use that to guide me through this new habits and new routines whilst getting myself prepared, really. And of course, there was going to be mornings where, you know, I was, you know, laying around in bed going, oh, you know, shall I work out today? Shall I not? And that kind of self-negotiation that goes through of us of going, yeah, should we work out today? Oh, no, no, let's just put it off. No, Steve, you promised yourself that you're going to be doing at least, you know, 4 to 5 workouts, you know, per week. You're at 4 now. Let's just do another one. And actually, we'll just reward you with some really lovely protein pancakes.
Good trade-off.
That's it. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I just use that to really kind of guide myself going, no, you promised yourself here. You was going to do this. We made a deal. Let's go and do it.
Nice. So tell me about the Kilimanjaro trek, then.
Oh man, that was amazing. Absolutely loved it. Yeah, it was fantastic. And you know what? I just love that kind of sense of togetherness that we get from a team of fellow trekkers and mountain dwellers, you know, who just all come together. We don't know each other, but we know something about each other already. And we want to go and experience this adventure together. And, you know, we don't know each other, but actually it's, we know about each other already, and that's what we want to do. And let's come together. Let's go do this. And I really loved that. Really, really loved that sense of kind of togetherness for the team as well. And loved the mountain guides and the porters. They were absolutely fantastic. Loved the Swahili culture
of
Tanzania. That was absolutely fantastic. Yeah, loved it. And so, yeah, we was, I can't remember now, I think it was around about 2 weeks, the trek was. I decided to, coming from the west, because you've got multiple routes that you can, you know, do on Kilimanjaro. So we came in from the west, it was called the Lemosho route. So that allowed for an extra day for acclimatization. So ultimately, it's, you know, the main thing is you trek high, but you sleep low in terms of the altitude. So by lunchtime you want to get to, let's say, 2,000 meters. Okay, by lunchtime you would do that. You're currently at 1,500, so you want to get to elevation of 500 by lunchtime. Great, we come back down to that exactly the same spot where we kind of started off at, but maybe further on down like the route. Yeah. But yeah, like the mountain guides kind of took care of that for us. But ultimately, I think it was really important to go, okay, you know, you're training hard because what you want to do is you want to, you know, get your body to acclimatize and adapt to this new zone.
Yeah.
And you do that around 7 days all in all, where we first started to where we got up to the summit was 7 days. And ultimately that was the philosophy from what we was doing, and drinking lots of water. Mm-hmm. And of course having lots of garlic soup, because there is a belief that actually garlic helps with the altitude.
Oh really?
Yeah, apparently so. And do you know what? It was absolutely fine. Loved it. So yeah, it was good.
I take it you like garlic then.
Yeah, it's all right.
Well, yeah, yeah. So you're kind of going up. Back down a bit, up, back down a bit.
Yeah.
And then did you gradually increase. Where you were sleeping? Yeah, okay, right, yeah. And how high is Kilimanjaro?
Yeah, so it's 5,895 meters.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the highest freestanding mountain in the world, one of the seven summits. And also, yeah, it's, yeah, it's around 19,000 feet, 18,000 feet, something like that. So yeah, that was a really great realization about when we went to, you know, go and land, like the plane where we was just coming into like the airport. I was like, oh, okay, look to your left, and there's Kilimanjaro. I'm like, wow, that's where we're going. Oh my God, what have I got myself in for? Yeah, that was great.
And how did you feel when you got to the top?
Oh man, lots of amazing emotions. Of course, I was emotional. I was really emotional. I was, you know, I think, you know, I was really reflective on like the summit, and I would, just carry those feelings for the rest of my days of being really reflective and really, you know, feeling that kind of sense of, you know, accomplishment. But ultimately, you know, there was points of where I didn't actually, you know, felt as if I was going to be making it. There were some difficulties for me, especially for, because I packed a really heavy kind of rucksack, because I was like, yeah, let's load up the water. I made that kind of mistake of like, you know, really packing my bag for a lot of food, a lot of drink. And actually, you know, that caused a bit of kind of, issues, because actually what I didn't expect is things naturally feel a bit more heavier at altitude.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was some kind of difficulties. And actually on the summit night, I think it was around about -15, -20 at the time.
Wow.
And one thing which I didn't realize is where you've got the camelbacks, get an insulator for it. And I thought, great, because we're trying to avoid it to freeze. It froze anyway. And when I was doing my kind of preparation of getting my equipment, I was just like, well, you know, spending quite a lot of money here, so let me just get those water bottles here, and didn't really check what they can go down to without freezing. My water bottle froze.
Oh really?
Man, it was difficult. So yeah, you know, I was trying to get a chisel and trying to get some ice out, and you know, trying to warm it up a little bit. So
yeah.
Eventually, you know, it was fine. I had a water slush puppy, mate.
No, oh, lovely.
So yeah, that was great. But yeah, ultimately, I think summit night was just absolutely beautiful. I never knew how beautiful our world is at altitude, and seeing the sunrise at altitude, and seeing the sun coming over the horizon like that, and seeing the Milky Way, seeing the stars, and just, you know, the natural surroundings being simply silent, and you know, all you're hearing is your heart just punching through your chest, and then you've got ringing ears due to the altitude, and everything else is just simply silent there, and you know, you're kind of pacing yourself up the mountain as well. And I kind of felt that element of self-doubt coming into me of going, can I do this? This feels really far away.
Yeah.
And I'm blowing. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, the best way to describe things at altitude for me is, do you know, when you kind of work out, when you run, and you know, you get that element of oh, I think I'm reaching my top here, and that feeling of going, maybe we should stop here. That feeling. So imagine that continuously, but only walking pigeon steps. So it's that kind of element of you need to be patient, but you need to be persistent, but you need to just have a little balance between the two.
Yeah.
Just making sure that you are, you know, pacing the right way for you, but also just making sure that, you know, you're attending to your well-being more than anything. And certainly being aware about drinking more water, getting some more snacks, getting that energy up, getting the glucose in, have a nice bottle of, like, you know, fizzy drink or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that was really important. But again, with that kind of self-doubt, it was because it felt very far away.
Yeah.
In like, I was kind of looking up of going, well, I'm not even seeing the top right now. It's at like 2:30, 3 a.m. in the morning. Mm-hmm. We're going for like a few more hours. How can I do this? I'm blowing already. And actually what I kind of found, as if that was really important to me of doing, is I need to kind of break it down.
Mm-hmm.
And we were taking regular breaks. So rather than feeling that, okay, I need to make, you know, the summit ridge. No. Make it to the next break time.
Yeah.
Make it to the next break time. What are you going to do at that break time? Oh, you know, I'm going to have this, you know, a double decker bar. Absolutely love them. Skittles. Yeah. Have that. And, you know, let's have some more water, some fizzy drink, just to ward myself of getting to that checkpoint.
Yeah.
And just eventually you're making yourself up that. And what I also noticed is the things which really helped me at that time of, you know, have that element of self-doubt is, you know, we all get that way sometimes where, you know, some kind of negative thoughts may kind of come into your mind of that elements of self-doubt. And I think it's really important to actually kind of remind yourself of going, no, you are doing this. Let's have some positive, empowering thoughts. And what kind of helps with me, and I didn't really intend to do this, it just happened, and I wanted to visualize myself at the summit. What am I feeling? What am I sensing? What am I knowing? What am I seeing? And getting into that kind of granular detail, and that kind of really helped with me to shift that kind of self-doubt into more kind of positive, empowering thoughts. And it kind of led for me to have that sense of motivation and determination to continue, and breaking it down along with that kind of visualization part. Yeah, it certainly really helped me. And, you know, I kind of learned that along the way, and I'm sure, you know, everyone has their, you know, various different ways of, you know, attending, you know, to themselves. And that's ultimately what worked with me. And when I got to summit and I looked down and realized how far I've come, I thought it was a really important metaphor to, you know, kind of take with me and bottle that.
Yeah. Because like some of the stuff you said just there is things that are taught now to help people achieve goals, right? The whole visualization, breaking down goals into like smaller chunks.
Yeah.
But it seemed like it was just something that naturally came to you. Well, I guess when you have that pressure, you have to find ways to cope, right? Otherwise you don't.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you got to find ways for yourself, and, you know, attending to what, you know, is going to be important for you at that time. Definitely. And that kind of worked for me. So yeah, definitely it was good.
So you got to obviously the peak of Kilimanjaro, felt that you physically and mentally cope with it. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely fine. Yeah. You know, definitely it was, you know, I found it difficult, but actually it was just a fantastic adventure. And that really sparked for me to, you know, go ahead and continue with some more adventures and some more travel, which certainly with what I did, I went to Mount Toubkal. So that was in Morocco, the Atlas Mountains. So that was a 4,500-meter peak there. And then my wife, Katie, so we went and did the kind of sabbatical thing for about 5 to 6 months. So we traveled into various different kind of countries, and that was absolutely fantastic. But also what I wanted to do is I wanted to, you know, have another adventure after that, going into the Himalayas. But when I got back from Kilimanjaro, I was like, right, what's next? What do I want to, you know, go ahead and do? And initially, I wanted to go and book for this mountain called Aconcagua, which is on the borderline of Argentina and Chile, because my kind of love of seeing, you know, sunrises at altitude, I wanted to go and see that at the Andes. Like, yeah. That would be absolutely beautiful. And when I phoned up to inquire about it, it was, well, okay, it's great that you've done Kilimanjaro, but actually you need 6,000 meter experience. Yeah, it's not too far away, but come back to us when you've done a 6,000 meter peak. I was like, okay, well, what other 6,000 meter peaks are there out there? It's like, well, Nepal, let's go and do that. So yeah, you know, that is going to be the, you know, like the trekking and climbing hub of like the climbing world. So I was like, right, let's go and find one out here. So I found Mirror Peak. So that was 6,476 meters. Went ahead and did that. And I was like, looked at it. I was like, okay, well, this is the highest trekking peak in the pool. When you get to the summit, you get to see the 4 out of 5 highest mountains in the world all in one view.
Yeah.
I was like, that view is going to be absolutely spectacular. I need to go and see that. That is going to be brilliant. Yeah. So I was like, okay, cool. So what we did is Katie did her some solo adventures for herself as well. And I did my solo adventure, like myself, like my friend Paul came with me as well. So that was great. But also when we got there, oh man, it was just absolutely fantastic. So yeah, gotta love the Himalayas.
So for people who don't do a lot of hiking or trekking, what's the difference between, so it's the highest trekking peak, right?
Yes, that's
so
right.
So what is above that and what's the difference between the two?
Yeah, so what we've got is we've got Mount Everest, which is the highest in the world, and that's 8,848 meters, and that's 29,000 feet, whereas Mirror Peak, that is 21,000 feet, and that's at 6,476 meters. Now, the difference between the two is the technicality of the mountain. So, for example, you'll be on the glacier a lot more on Everest, whereas you would only be on like the glacier for about like 1 day or 2 days at the very most. And when you're on like on the glacier, it's going to be the gradient, and it's going to be what the kind of technicals you need. So you're going to need crampons, you're going to need ice axes, you're going to need fixed line ropes, but that intensifies the higher and steeper the gradient is. So yeah, I'm sure there's other different ways and different, you know, approaches to, you know, articulate and explain that, but of course, yeah, just from my perspective, just on that, that's how I would kind of look at it. And of course there is mountain grading as well, so it grades between the technicality and the steepness on those mountains. But yeah, our one, Mirror Peak, that was the trekking peak. So relatively kind of mellow in terms of, you know, kind of trekking. But yeah, you know, Mount Everest and, you know, places like K2, Cho Yu, they are going to be more kind of like, you know, full on, more kind of hectic, more kind of wild.
So they're kind of more difficult and you need more kit kind of thing.
Yeah, for sure. And you need way more experience as well.
Yeah. You can't just go into Everest and crack on, can you?
Yeah, no, definitely not.
So before we talk about Mirror Peak, you did one before, right?
So that was the Atlas Mountain. So that was Mount Tubcal.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a really enjoyable trek on that one.
Which is not as high as Kilimanjaro, am I right?
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely.
And how was that?
Yeah, it was a really enjoyable experience again. You know, meeting with you know, fellow trekkers who we don't know each other, like my wife and our friend Kegs as well. That came with us as well, so that was really great. And also we met you know, other mountain you know, trekkers as well, so that was brilliant as well. So yeah, and we spent a couple of days in Marrakesh as well.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, that's it. So it's good.
How did that compare to Kilimanjaro?
They, they have different kind of experiences more than anything. I think ultimately you have different gradients and different type of terrain.
Yeah.
Whereas Mount Tucal was more kind of rocky, but actually a Kilimanjaro, actually you've got, you know, five different ecological kind of zones.
Yeah.
So you go through, like, you know, the desert, you go through, you know, elements, well, not a lot of the kind of glacier, but, you know, there is some rocky terrain as well. So you go through different kind of zones, but whereas with Mount Tucal, it's more kind of rocky.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there was some really steep bits in places as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. And then obviously moving on to Mirror Peak, which is Himalayas, which for those who don't know is like the kind of climbing central of the of the world, so to speak, mainly because it's got, like you say, four of the biggest mountains in the world there.
Yeah.
And how was that experience?
Oh, it was breathtaking, excuse the pun. Absolutely breathtaking. and, you know, actually seeing the sights of the Himalayas and the icy glacier mountains for the first time was just absolutely beautiful. It was fantastic. And, you know, just having that kind of sense of, you know, adventure. Well, I never really, you know, initially like intended to go to the Himalayas because I wanted to go to Aconcagua. But since experiencing the Himalayas, I want to go back there.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's just so many different amazing treks that one can do around the Himalayas. And yeah, you know, going to the, you know, different tea houses and, you know, they've got monasteries as well over there. So, you know, not only you're kind of trekking the whole way through, but you're getting to, you know, kind of spend time with the local people there as well.
Yeah.
And just, you know, enjoying what the great outdoors has to offer.
Yeah.
At the Himalayas, because it's absolutely beautiful. Yeah.
And did you, what was your kind of training leading into that?
Yeah, different. Extremely different to Kilimanjaro. And I need to be quite creative and be quite adaptable because I was traveling for five to 6 months prior to going to Mirror. So we was, you know, going to 12 different countries and, you know, getting to kind of enjoy that kind of sense of travel and adventure going through different countries. But also what I need to do is I needed to adapt my training routine around that as well. And, you know, for like diet, I did the best that I can, of course, but I wanted to try, like, you know, all like the local foods that, you know, one, you know, each country has to offer. But in New York, I wanted to try and figure out what a great run would be. So it would be, okay, using Google Maps to kind of explore what a 5K route would be.
Yeah.
And that was a really, really great way to kind of, you know, see various different cities by, okay, we're in this city next week or this week. What is the kind of training routes that I'll be taking here? So initially it was New York. So it was just, you know, doing a bit of a kind of circle loop for it's just one side of the Hudson River, just on the New Jersey side. So just ran up and down that once during like the morning. So that was really nice. Also around New Zealand as well. So walking around kind of different harbors and just making sure I'm doing some HIIT workouts as well.
Yeah.
So that was important for various different places as well. So I tended to use that kind of philosophy of like maintaining HIIT workouts, but also, you know, attending 5Ks or 10Ks in different kind of countries. So it was more kind of forward thinking and forward planning for that.
Yeah.
And then trying to use gyms when kind of necessary as well. And even when I was in Vietnam, I tried to find some gyms, and it was really like interesting to see people using dumbbells while smoking as well.
Really?
Yeah.
That's quite a novel take on things, isn't it?
Absolutely. I just walked into the gym. It's like, how comes it smells of cigarette smoke? It's like, oh, okay. So yeah, that was ultimately like, you know, my kind of training routine behind that. So it was certainly different. Mm-hmm. And, you know, did I train to the intensity to what I was for a Kilimanjaro? No, but actually I did a lot of work physically for myself prior. So it was around maintaining that.
Yeah.
But also, ensuring that I don't miss a trick when it comes to my experience and what type of things that I need to look out for based on what I learn. Like things, for example, of making sure that you've got decent water bottles, making sure your water don't freeze, you know, and just ensuring that you're packing light, eradicate the small problems before they get into big problems.
Yeah.
All those types of, you know, things that I learned from Kilimanjaro is certainly kind of transferable to that. So it was a kind of level playing field between, okay, well, I haven't trained as much as I have, but I put in the work in before, but I've maintained it, but also I've got more experience.
Yeah.
So that kind of set me up for mirror there. Yeah.
Nice. And did you feel like your fitness again, like physically and mentally, you felt quite capable at the end?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I felt, you know, really, really still fit and mentally strong as well. And certainly, you know, I was just definitely looking forward to that adventure of going up to Mirror Peak as well. So yeah, absolutely loved it. So it was a fantastic experience.
And I mean, I would assume it was challenging along the way.
Yeah, Summit Night was, yeah, it was full on. I think the two words which I choose to describe Summit Night at Mirror Peak was, it was beautifully relentless. And I use beautifully like, well, it's simply silent. It's around minus 20, something like that. And all you see is your head torch in front of you. You've got your crampons. You've got, you know, your harnesses. You're roped up as well.
Yeah.
And all you're seeing throughout your head torch is these beautiful stars, like above you, and it's just absolutely beautiful. And it was the same process of what I used for Kilimanjaro is actually quite transferable to Mirror Peak as well. So I was roped up with a few people that actually were pacing quite faster than me.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was quite difficult to try and manage and maintain. And again, there was a few things which upon the glacier as well, there were crevasses, and the crevasses are basically like big water towers.
Yeah.
Actually, they're all, you know, iced, but actually there are some parts of where it's actually where it's kind of separated out. So actually there was bits where you would have to jump over, and you don't want to go in one of them. And that's the reason why you've got an ice act. And that's the reason why you've got fixed line ropes as well, to making sure that anyone does go, actually you're, you know, breaking that fall with the ice axe and being all roped up with that. So yeah, so that was that element of kind of risk and that, you know, quite fearful with that as well, but ultimately, yeah, it's just around kind of taking your time when you're, you know, going through those kind of crevasse crossings. You know, it wasn't that much of like, you know, a massive thing, because usually when you do Mount Everest or other 8,000 or 7,000 meter peaks, or even 6,000 ones like Island Peak, actually, that you need to have ladders to help you cross, because actually they've, you know, it, like the gaps are massive, but actually for like Mirror Peak, it's relatively kind of mellow. So you just need to jump over them, but you need to leave a good, like kind of stepping ground, because actually the snow could be quite weaker.
Yeah.
The closer you get to the crevasse. So you need to be jumping in good measurement and landing in good measurement. Otherwise it could, you know, break that fall.
Yeah.
It could get bigger because of the impact.
Yeah.
Which could cause risk on that one. But yeah, we were all good with that one. There was no issues with that. And yeah, you know, we kind of got to halfway. That was at like about 4:30 in the morning. And the sunrise over the Himalayas was absolutely brilliant. I loved it. Oh my God. Yeah, it was something which, well, you know, I would never take away from my memory for that one. That was brilliant. And then I just kept on going and just getting patient, but being persistent in, in terms of that trek. And when we got to the summit, I just went up and just looked at that view, and seeing places like Choyu, Mount Everest, Lhotse, Makalu, Chang'an, all those 8,000 meter peaks all in one view, that was just absolutely beautiful. It was fantastic.
And how long do you end up staying up there?
So that trek, it lasts around 3 weeks,
mm-hmm.
But also we're, of course, using the same kind of philosophy of going trekking high, sleeping low. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, it's a 6,000 and a half meter peak, but actually you're doing like probably double the amount of distance that you're doing.
Yeah.
Because of the altitude and because of you need to adapt, you know, yourself to the altitude. So
how long do you stay at the top for when you reach the...
I think we stayed up there. It was around about like 15, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And of course that you need to get your kind of mandatory kind of summit photos. And yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I've got a story here actually. So I went up, right? I don't know what happened. I think it's the altitude that caused you know, my kind of decision making to be you know, compromised. But I felt like, okay, I need to take a photo of this, but I was still wearing my mountain mitts and my touchscreen phone didn't work. All of a sudden the phone slipped out of my hand and it just like sudden gust of wind just blew it off, went to slide off the south face of like the mountain. And then I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to stop it with my foot. I need to remember where my crampon spikes, right? Completely spiked my phone.
No way.
I was like, okay, well, I can't really take a photo of it now. Yeah. Now, you know, I've got this broken phone. But yeah, I used another one, Sherpa's phone, to take the Mantaray Summit photo for that one. So
amazing.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how, like, what, how did you find the experience with like the Sherpas?
They are the most humble and most experienced and most determined people that I've met. And it's really amazing about how they've adapted to the climate there and also the work that they do. Like even the porters, right? They're about 13, 14 years old and they're carrying massive rucksacks for their clients, and doing that at high altitude, getting on glaciers when at that time, mm-hmm. like, you know, 13 or 14 years old, and I was only getting paid around like, you know, $14 to $15 per person.
Yeah.
All right. Wow. That's just you know, amazing to see that, and like, you know, the, you know, kind of difference that we have in terms of, you know, Western culture versus Eastern culture as well. And, you know, it was amazing to be a part of that culture. And, you know, upon the kind of descent, I was with a few other Sherpa. So for people who kind of don't know, Sherpa is, you know, a community that I've emigrated from Tibet. And they came to Nepal to search for work. And upon the work was mountain guides and portering. So when we refer to Sherpa, that's a community that have emigrated from Tibet rather than the work that they do, which is the Sherpa, mm-hmm. if you see what I mean. So,
yeah.
But also, yeah, you know, they're like that work, those are the reasons why the people that are able to, you know, go and trek those mountains.
Yeah.
Without them, no one can do it.
Yeah.
Well, they, you know, it's a, you know, certainly, you know, very important to, you know, use the Sherpa and, you know, use people while they're out there, because it's really important to, you know, draw from that experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess as well, like, you're almost, you're giving back into the community that you're a guest in, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Yeah.
So obviously, so we've done Mirror Peak.
Mm-hmm.
And what has kind of led on after that for you?
Yeah, I think it was about, you know, from that perspective now, it's around, you know, getting back into the normal working world.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with like the kind of normal working world now, actually, you know, that, you know, we've kind of got that sense of adventure and that sense of travel, which is really important. And I think now where I am is actually my hip condition now is resurfaced. Mm-hmm. I'm currently waiting for another procedure. It's kind of like a very kind of mellow one. It's you know, ultimately it's going to be an injection, hopefully, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
And once that gets all kind of back on with I'm going to take on that journey again of getting back on it. And hopefully one day I'll quite like to do, you know, another, perhaps like even like a 7,000 meter peak or even an 8,000 meter peak one day. And kind of, you know, seeing the work that kind of, you know, Nims and Kristen are doing. So Kristen is, oh man, she's almost doing it. I think she's up to 8 peaks out of the 14 now.
She's the 21-year-old, right? Is that, or is that someone else?
Don't know her age, but she's from Oslo. So she did, how many peaks did she do? She's just done, in this season alone, she did around 6 peaks in a month in the pool, and those are the 8,000 meter peaks.
That's incredible.
It's crazy. Yeah, oh my God. Like, you know, the work that, you know, they do. Yeah, it's brilliant. Absolutely love it.
Yeah.
Great to follow them. Great to see their stories.
Have you got any mountains in mind for the future?
Do you know what? I had one, which was, initially I was thinking about Himalayan Kamal and then also Amadabalam. But actually Amadabalam, that was more of a kind of technical, peak, which requires some more experience. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to, you know, get ahead and, you know, do some kind of rock climbing here. But actually there were some limitations for me that was resurfacing for my hip. So I was just like, well, I need to kind of park that for now, take care of the hip. I want to get back on that in like the future and hopefully do, perhaps even Himalayan Kamal, or if not, Amadabalam are going to be those ones. And they're going to be around about like 6,800 meters. And that's for Amadabalam. And then Himalayan Kamal, that's going to be 7,100 meters as well. So around about that kind of aspect on things, really. And those are going to be my 8,000 meter peaks, I think. It's all about scale, and I think that's going to be my one for me.
I mean, it's not far off, right? Like in terms of what most people experience. Since you've been back, how have the experiences of, you know, trekking these mountains and the experiences that you've had on them, how have they, helped or built into your life now?
Yeah, I think the big word that's showing up for me right now is perspective.
Uh-huh.
And that word perspective is something which is always growing. And I think travel and the adventures that have allowed me to really broaden my perspective. And of course, you know, that's always still growing for me. Yeah. I'm always still kind of developing that perspective, and based on those experiences and those adventures, it just allowed me to grow my perspective even more. And certainly knowing, because I wanted to go away and do some travel and go do some adventures, and what my perspective was going, well, I want to explore the differences of what different countries have. But actually I came back with learning the similarities that we have together.
Yeah.
It's something which was really important to me, that we all want happiness. We all want to contribute to our family. We all want to, you know, lead a, you know, happy, fulfilling life. Right. And, you know, love just binds us all kind of together. And yeah, that was something which was very familiar and very similar with what I kind of experienced. But ultimately, I found differences as well with our perspective in the West world, whereas in the Eastern world, we might have a different perspective and different kind of take on things. And yeah, that was really important for me to kind of immerse myself within different cultures in order to broaden my perspective out there a bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. How has, you know, being in those, because you're so entrenched within nature there, right? Like, and I can imagine that can only have had like such a big effect on you. How has that changed how's that changed your outlook on the world?
I just think there is, ultimately, from what we're seeing, is we are seeing the climate changing,
mm-hmm.
and seeing that firsthand is very alarming, to see the differences with what we're seeing for the climate. And, you know, both from, I think, for the experiences that we've had is just only going to add to that kind of building that perspective and the ongoing learning. And actually, I think it's important for us to, you know, learn from different perspectives, but also not posing different beliefs on other people, but, you know, stay curious for longer and learn about, you know, different cultures and different ways of beliefs, and learning from each other. Is this something which I've kind of taken from based on my experience with the people that I've had, like, had the pleasure of, you know, talking to, on like the sense of achievement of adventure and what it kind of brings.
And say someone is sitting here listening to our conversation now and thinks, do you know what, like, that sounds amazing, I would love to experience that. What would your advice to them be in how to get started?
Yeah, I just think main thing is find out whatever works for them, but also have that sense of belief, and it's being okay with not knowing how things are going to go. And sometimes it's okay. Of course, you know, we all talk around positive mentality, positive mindset. Yeah, of course, that's what we need to get to, but we're humans, right? So sometimes there is an element of self-doubt, and, you know, that may creep in. But again, it's around that kind of self-awareness thing around, and just discover physical and mental limits and discover how much more that you can achieve. And yeah, go and enjoy yourself and have fun and learn.
Brilliant. If someone wanted to reach out and talk to you and ask you about your experiences, what's the best way of them kind of getting a hold of you?
Yeah, of course. So yeah, two platforms. You've got Instagram. So it's going to be Stephen Andrews. So Stephen spelled with a V. So that's Stephen Andrews one on Instagram, but also on LinkedIn. So you've got Stephen Andrews as well, spelled with a V on that one. So yeah, that is going to be the two platforms to reach out. And you're more than welcome to reach out to me. I'm looking forward to kind of connecting with like-minded people. So definitely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time and for sharing like all your amazing experiences.
No, cool. Well, thank you ever so. Yeah, thank you ever so much for having me, and, you know, to our listeners as well. And if you made it this far, thank you. And it's really, really great to have you with us as well. So thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you.